Those were all his ideas.
Just the ones that get me into trouble.
Right. So it's November 9th, 2010. We are interviewing Mr. David Einhorn of Greenlight Capital. Mr. Einhorn, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. My name is Chris Seifer. I'm with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. With me today is Claire Moraine. We were created by a statute enacted last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that tasks us with figuring out the various causes of the financial crisis and delivering a report by the end of this year, actually in about a month. That statute includes many things for us to look at. And we figured, given your background at Greenlight and what you've been doing for the last several years, it made sense to talk to you. So with that, let's just dive right into it. My understanding is that you started Greenlight and have been there since 1996, right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's just go right into the areas that we had talked about with your counsel before. And that is, I think, just generally the first thing I want to ask you is, generally, what were you looking at that made you short the companies that you did, both, company-specific and, non-company-specific factors?
And this is like in the fall-ish of 07, this concept of time period?
Yeah, you don't need to limit yourself to 07. I mean, if you were noticing things, for example, in the housing market before then, and that caused you to short housing-related companies or otherwise, I'd be interested in hearing that. But certainly we're also interested in 07 and 08.
Okay. We short a lot of companies in a lot of different areas. It's just part of our ongoing business. We're also long a lot of companies in a lot of areas. In fact, we're always long more than we're short, and our primary business is that we're always sort of long biased, if you would.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's important, because we may talk a lot about the short selling and so forth, that you recognize, or anyone who's listening recognizes, that that our primary business is with a long bias towards things. The first financial shorts that we shorted that pertain to the general topic that I understand that you're investigating were the monoline bond insurers,
mm-hmm.
most particularly MBIA and then later AMBAC, with the MBIA short really commencing, I think, in 2002, by which point we had realized that their business model didn't make any sense. And later, as we investigated that over a number of years, we became very concerned relating to how MBIA was relating to other participants in what later became the financial crisis, most particularly the credit rating agencies, and later eventually the investment banks. We had got a much more heightened sense that of the coming credit crisis in August of 2007.
Mm-hmm.
The most clearly precipitating event in my mind was when BNP Paribas froze the money markets of some of their customers,
mm-hmm.
which struck me as reflecting a complete failure of the securitizations. And that combined with a view that a lot of AAA-rated securities had been purchased by entities and people, including foreign people and entities, that simply did not want to assess the creditworthiness of what they were buying, and they bought it because it was AAA. I felt that the failure of the AAA securities was going to lead to a rejection of securitization.
Mm-hmm.
And so in August of 2007, we did sort of a quick research project to identify companies where their business was reliant upon securitization. And when we found them, and I think we found approximately two dozen over the course of a weekend,
mm-hmm.
that was the basis for instituting short positions, pending doing additional work.
And so were those the 24 companies that were dependent on securitizations? You don't need to list me all 24 by name, but generally what types of companies were they? Were they the iBanks and various mortgage companies and things like that?
Yeah, they were investment banks, they were commercial banks, they were certain companies that were dependent on real estate, they were the rating agencies, the bond insurers, the mortgage guarantors, and I might have missed a miscellaneous one or two, but that's the gist of where they were.
I know from looking at some of the things you've written before, some of your speeches, at least in terms of MBIA, I think you wrote that, you know, in addition, that over time, you know, one, they were becoming more leveraged, and two, they went from just insuring, you know, municipal securities to insuring, you know, structured credit. What was there other facts besides those two things that got you concerned about MBIA, and I take it by extension AMBAC and the other monolines?
Yeah, I came to the view that first of all, the business itself didn't make any sense. That the business was to take credit risk for a small fraction of what the market said the credit spread was. I mean, that's the premise of the business. The market says credit spread is 200 basis points. We will insure it for 50 basis points. The insured bond will trade 100 basis points tighter, so the issuer will split the savings with us. We'll keep 50, and they'll keep 50, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't understand why it would make sense to have a business that charges 50 basis points to take what the whole rest of the market says is 200 basis points of credit risk.
Mm-hmm.
As a general proposition. And as we investigated it, we realized a couple of things. The first was that the accounting was giving them reasonable economics because the accounting itself wasn't describing the economics.
And
the company put up loss provisions that were by definition a percentage of premium. Mm-hmm. As opposed to a measure of the actual risk that they had taken on. So literally, if you were going to charge a dollar of premium and you were going to put up, I think, 10% of that as a loss reserve, call it 10 cents. I forget what the exact figure was. If you came in the next day, reduced your price, and charged 50 cents to take the same risk, now you would put up a loss reserve of only 5 cents. So the less they charged, the worse the deal was for them,
mm-hmm.
and the lower loss provision that they provided. The second was they were front-loading the revenue recognition relating to the premiums, particularly on the structured finance business. They had this convoluted way of saying that the risk was expiring on an accelerated basis,
mm-hmm.
even though we believed that the accounting rules said that the risk needed to expire actually as the principal and interest payments were being made. In other words, if you had a zero coupon, if you had a bond and it was just a single payment and it was in 10 years,
mm-hmm.
after 1 year, you still were insuring the full value. None of the risk was expiring, but MBIA would have recognized 10% of the profit on that.
Mm-hmm.
1 year had passed. And we wrote various letters to the SEC and to the accounting authority. What are those guys in Connecticut called?
The FASB?
FASB, yeah, on this topic. And we met with FASB to discuss it.
Okay.
So we thought that their accounting was bad. Then, if you fast forward, then there was the question of, as it became clear that MBIA's business was actually impaired, why was it that the rating agencies were so reluctant to take away their AAA rating? And from that, we identified a major conflict with the rating agencies, which was that the rating agencies loved having monoline bond insurers rating, say, municipalities and structured finance for that matter, because once they were insured, they could be rated AAA, and the rating agency didn't need to actually monitor the deals.
Well, I mean, I hear you saying that, but I mean, if the rating agency sees a monoline insurer insuring a deal, presumably they're looking at the monoline insurer.
That's right. That was the rationale. So the rationale was it was very effective for the rating agencies to leave the monolines at AAA because they didn't have to check whether, you know, XYZ municipality in California was screwing around with their pension. Because as long as MBIA had guaranteed it, they didn't have to worry about that bond. It was AAA.
Right.
But the corollary to that was if they downgraded MBIA, they were going to have to review literally tens of thousands of credits.
Did you ever talk to the folks at the, I mean, I think I've read you saying that before, that, you know, one of the reasons they had an incentive not to, to downgrade the monolines is because then they'd have to do more work on what the monolines were insuring. Did you ever have any discussions with the credit rating agencies about that?
Yes, I did. I went to Moody's office and discussed it with them.
And when did you do that, and what did they say?
That meeting had to have been approximately late 2007, maybe even a little bit before that. I would have to check.
If it helps, they did the mass downgrades of the RMBS in July of 2007, and then the CDOs in October of 2007.
Yeah, and when did they get around to actually downgrading MBIA?
That I don't know off the top of my head.
Right. The answer is I'm not sure, but I think it was late 2007, and we could get back and get you an exact date because there's a record of this.
Okay.
Okay. But in any case, when I met with them, their basic attitude was, and they had half a dozen people in the room, including their most senior people, was that they were on a listening tour. They weren't going to react to anything that I said.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say I got no reaction, but the idea that there were that this conflict I identified and pointed out to them, it certainly didn't strike them as something. You could tell from the body reaction in the room that, you know, I wasn't telling them anything they didn't already know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Who did you meet with?
But then, yeah, do you recall who you actually met with at Moody's?
There'd be a record of that. I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay. Was that your only meeting with them?
Yeah, it was just one meeting.
Okay. Did you meet with any of the folks at either S&P or Fitch?
No.
Okay. Did you talk to the SEC or other folks about the concerns about the rating agencies?
Not in this context, no.
Okay. What context did you, if that's what that meant?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't remember any conversation with the SEC.
Okay. Okay, so as I hear, I guess I want you to continue to sort of chronologically. In August of 2007, you know, as you said, you know, you see BNP Paribas freeze redemptions, and that gives concern, and you're talking to the rating agencies, amongst other things, and you've identified the types of companies that you had concerns about. Can you just sort of take us through, chronologically, through the end of 2007 and into 2008, and how things changed, if at all, for you folks?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was sometime in August. We put on a bunch of positions, and then our team here basically divided up the names for sort of further work, and then because we wanted to figure out which were the ones that were the most exposed. Whereas the initial couple dozen was picked off relatively quickly over the course of a weekend, mm-hmm. which is not our normal amount of time to do diligence. But I felt that given what was going on, there may not be a lot of time. And so we began putting on those couple dozen positions a little bit faster than we ordinarily would if we were just researching an individual security. So from there, we began concentrating our work and trying to figure out, well, which were the better, more exposed companies and which were the less exposed companies. And over the course of the next couple of months, we focused the list down, and we covered a number of the shorts, and we increased a number of the shorts as we, focused on to the people that we thought were most vulnerable.
And generally, do you recall what companies you found to be most vulnerable? I mean, of course, we all know about Lehman.
Yeah, I think the ultimate list would be something close to Lehman, Bear, MBIA, AMBAC, Moody's, Wells Fargo, HSBC.
So the one to me anyway that sort of sounds curious out of that list is Wells. How come, do you recall why they were on the list? I didn't know that they had a big subprime or real estate mortgage exposure.
Wells was actually the number one originator of subprime mortgages in 2006, according to the industry statistics. Now, they subsequently deny that they ever originated a single subprime mortgage, which is interesting. It's inconsistent with what happened in 2006.
Right. Okay.
You know, I knew this when I was on the board of New Century. I mean, Wells was right there as a top competitor. I just emailed you something.
And then, you know I have this, but I just don't know off the top of my head. How long were you on the board of New Century? Do you remember when you joined it and when you left?
Yeah, it was less than a year.
Okay. Okay, so through the, you know, August, September, October 2007 time frame, as you continue to do due diligence.
That's right.
And cover and increase shorts on this smaller universe of companies,
right,
down from the two dozen. Can you continue the chronological story,
sure,
please?
Sure. As we, you know, as we concentrated on these particular ones, there was one thing that came out that was that I thought was very interesting, was the rating agencies held conference calls supporting the creditworthiness of the investment banks. And it was apparent to me, and each rating agency did it, it was apparent to me from listening to these conference calls that the rating agencies had little idea what was actually going on at the investment banks.
And why was that?
Well, for example, on one of the calls, they had said that the investment banks had done a lot of hedging of their credit risk. And I asked on the call, I said, where did they do all this hedging? Right? Because the amount of exposures were enormous. And it wasn't clear to me how a person could hedge such exposure. And the rating agency analyst who was on the call said, have you seen the volume on the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago? Which kind of set me into a research project of how do you hedge credit risk on the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago. And after doing research, we were able to determine that you can hedge interest rate risk there through various types of contracts, mm-hmm, but there is no instrument in Chicago at the Merc that allows one to hedge credit risk. Which literally meant that the rating agency analyst was making up on the phone an answer to a question to justify maintaining confidence in these banks.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were hearing that from the rating agencies as an example of why the investment banks were just fine, or my term, not yours. But, you know, I've seen in your writing that, you know, the concerns you've expressed over the past with the investment bank model was, you know, the ones that others have expressed, and that at least now a lot of people understand. You know, highly leveraged, short-term funding, not a whole lot of transparency on the balance sheet in terms of gross exposures, and in terms of derivative exposures. Could you talk about that a little and whether or not you see that as any kind of contributing cause to the financial crisis?
I don't know how to adopt what you just said. That seems to be commonly understood at this point. You know, I would add that the investment banks are further handicapped by paying out so much of their revenue in compensation.
Right, and
which causes them to earn returns on their equity, which is inadequate for the risk that they take, and also encourages them to take more risk because they pay out compensation as a percentage of gross revenue. Mm-hmm. So if you borrow an extra dollar and lend it and make a spread, or even a gross interest return, and you start paying that out in compensation, you've added leverage, you've added compensation, but you may not have added anything to your earnings.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I've seen in your writings that in a little more specifics on that, that, you know, there were concerns not only about the leverage but about the composition of capital, because of one, the net capital rule that the SEC adopted in 04 that, you know, allowed you to include hybrids and sub debt and deferred tax assets and all that kind of fun stuff.
Right.
In capital, I mean, do you have any opinions? And I've read some of your opinions about the SEC, but more broadly, do you have any opinions about, you know, why the SEC missed the boat, for lack of a better term, on you know, the level of capital, the quality of the composition of capital, et cetera, at the IBANCs?
Yeah. Can I supplement my previous answer before I answer that
question? Of course.
Okay. The other major thing with the investment banks that, you know, you didn't allude to is the use of the value of risk models.
Right.
Which make no sense, from my judgment, because they cut off the tail. And the whole point, in my view, of risk management is to prepare yourself for what happens in tail events. And second, because the people who are running the banks or who were involved with the banks understood that the risks and the tails were being cut off, they effectively were able to game the system by buying securities that in the model showed no tail risk and therefore required no capital or almost no capital.
Right. And so I guess I would add that to the same list of things that, yeah, you know, what do you why do you think, you know, the SEC didn't understand that, or if they did understand it, you know, didn't do something like, say, you got to hold more capital, you got to hold more long-term sources of funding, you got to hold more liquidity, period.
Right. But my understanding is that the SEC was told that, you know, you had banks in Europe that were under these kinds of value at risk standards, that the U.S. banks could not compete if the SEC did not adopt similar rules to what was going on in Europe. And so they bought into this whole analysis and recognized even at the time that it would lead to lower capital levels. There was a philosophy at the time that it was not in the bank's interest to blow themselves up, so therefore they wouldn't do that. And then there was the further deficiency that the SEC really allowed everybody to just do their own calculations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not at all clear that the SEC did anything to actually monitor the calculations or to test them the way, you know, like a bank examiner would. And so you had a lot of self-reported stuff, which led to enormous abuse. And I can't account for why the SEC behaved this way, other than it might have just been their political philosophy at the time to really allow the market to sort of sort all of this stuff out.
And again, did you ever talk, I mean, I know you've had issues with the SEC from reading stuff, but did you ever talk to them about, you know, your concerns about the investment banking model and all these specific points that we've been talking about?
No, when these changes were being done, I was unaware of the topic. So I was not in any way involved in that conversation.
Well, but, and I get back in, you know, 04 when the net capital rule is adopted back then, but in the 07, 08 time frame when you've identified a couple dozen companies and then narrowed it down to include at least two of the investment banks, Lehman and Bear, I take it at that point you and your folks at Greenlight, you know, sort of understood all these points we're talking about. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's accurate.
Okay. And at that time, are you having any conversations, I guess, not even just with the SEC, but with other folks about what is the SEC doing? And I've read, you know, the April 08 and the May 08 speeches, you know, where you address it there. But I'm just wondering, you know, what kind of conversations you were having either with other market participants or the SEC itself or other regulators or government officials about what you folks had identified as, you know, a fair amount of uncompensated risk in the IB model?
You know, we had very little in terms of external conversations aside from what, you know, I would say in the various speeches, which doesn't mean I didn't talk to anybody about anything, but it was not something that was terribly prevalent. We certainly didn't talk to the SEC about it. I wouldn't even know who to call.
Okay. So another thing that we've noticed that I sent to you, Mike, earlier in the week or over the weekend, I'm losing track of the days, was when we get into the first quarter of 07, you know, there were a fair amount of early adopters of FAS 157, and now we've got level 1, 2, and 3 asset disclosures coming in 10-Ks that, at least for the iBanks, are being filed in, I guess, the March time frame, since they had a November year-end back then. Did that kind of, and I read in your speeches that you saw that as providing some more transparency and appeared to provide some concerns because you were seeing, you know, basically concentrations of level 3 assets to tangible capital as opposed to gap capital. But could you talk a little about whether or not, you know, the disclosure in 1Q07 of the level 1, 2, and 3 assets provided any additional information for you folks, and more importantly, whether it provided concern to you folks?
Yeah, I mean, there were various times when we looked at that along with all of the other data, but I don't think, and so it was useful in certain circumstances, but I don't think broadly it was terribly important. And frankly, I think the more meaningful accounting change was the 159, which allowed the financial institutions to book gains based upon their own debt going down in value.
And did you see a big income statement impact from that, from 159?
Yeah, you did.
And you
still do to today. There are still financial institutions showing big income statement aspects of 159.
Let me take you back to we've been talking about the rating agencies a little, and how, you know, they had problems. Do you have any views or opinions on, because one of the things we've seen is that, you know, a lot of folks did simply appear to be relying on the ratings, particularly the AAA ratings. Any opinions about why a lot of investors simply relied on those as opposed to doing some additional due diligence?
I think that the rating agency AAA was marketed on a global basis for a long period of time as meaning that there was substantially no credit risk.
And I understand that. And my question is, do you have any, I mean, obviously it sounds like, you know, folks like you and the folks at Greenlight weren't saying, oh, it's a AAA, it must be great, let's go long. But it appeared a lot of people were. Again, any discussions with folks out there, any views on why at least it appears a lot of investors simply relied on the AAA rating without doing additional independent research?
Yeah. I think to take on the opinion that a AAA entity, you know, was rated something less than AAA may have not been that controversial, but the idea that a AAA entity would actually default was practically sacrilegious. This went on for a very long period of time. We had this with MBIA for 5 years running, and it wasn't AAA in 2002 or 2007 or any of the years in between, and probably the 10 years before. But to take that point of view, I mean, was a little bit like being a member of the Flat Earth Society. It was pretty far out there.
Now, one area that I suspect you may have some comments on and that we're asked to look at in the statute is the issue of short selling itself and whether or not that was any contributing cause to the financial crisis. And I've seen in some of your speeches and your writings where, you know, you've said that, you know, look, when companies start complaining about short sellers, that's a sign that perhaps they might be in trouble, one, and two, your own personal experiences of why is the SEC spending time looking at short selling instead of looking at public disclosures by public companies that may not be what they should be. So I guess my first question is, what role, if any, do you think short selling has as a contributing cause to the financial crisis? And my second question would be to, if you could, sort of give us a little more color on that trade-off that you, on that curiosity that you've talked about in your speeches and your articles about, you know, companies that are complaining about short sellers are probably, or could be the ones that are in trouble.
Yeah. I don't have any knowledge of short selling contributing to the financial crisis. And I sort of don't think that it did. I think market participants, you know, react to the fundamentals, and that's what causes security prices to move.
Mm-hmm.
The odd behavior of people shooting the messenger when they can't engage in a substantive debate, I don't think that that's controversial at all. I think that's sort of, unfortunately, standard warfare in today's, you know, playbook of what do you do if you've got your hand caught in the cookie jar? You attack the messenger.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there's stories out there, or at least anecdotes, you know, that oh, you know, all these hedge funds get together and decide to target a company and drive its stock price down. And again, just the basic question: have you ever heard or seen of anything like that?
Well, I've heard the anecdotes.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know when these things happen and who's there. I heard there was a champagne brunch celebrating the fall of Bear Stearns, but I don't know anybody who was there. I don't think it existed.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is folklore, as far as I can tell, you know, propagated by people who, you know, want to invent explanations for things that suit whatever their purposes are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we do know that the SEC at least apparently investigated potential short selling of Bear and Lehman, I think, in, you know, the March 08 time frame and the September 08 time frame, and did not find that there was any causal connection between short selling and those firms' demise. So at least they've done that. So let me ask you about something else that is in our statute and that I think you've spoken to before, and that's the issue of mark-to-market accounting. I mean, it's another area that folks ask us to look at, and that, you know, the argument on the one side is, look, when you're in a period of declining asset prices, particularly with illiquid securities that where there's not a lot of price transparency, and you're in, you know, panic markets, for lack of a better word, that mark-to-market accounting is a problem because it requires firms to, particularly iBanks that are primarily mark-to-market books with trading securities, to mark their assets down, you know, to quote-unquote fire sale prices. That just becomes a vicious cycle. Do you have any views on that?
My view is that if the rules by the accounting authorities are set up to require mark-to-market accounting, then the participants in the market ought to follow them. If the accounting authorities decide that we shouldn't have mark-to-market accounting, then the participants in the market should follow those. But my attitude is that whatever the rules are, market participants should follow the rules.
Do you have an opinion on what the rules should be?
I think it depends for different institutions, you know, in different ways and what they're doing. And I think people need to set up their businesses in a way that accommodates the risk that they have. I mean, the mark-to-market accounting was put in, as I understand it, at the instigation of the very same banks that wound up complaining about the mark-to-market accounting because they wanted to mark in the gains the minute they happened so they could pay bonuses.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, look, I think there's good reasons for different types of things to either be marked to market or not be marked to market based upon the business purpose of why the assets are being held. And I would not want to make a blanket statement as to what should and shouldn't be, you know, marked to market.
Let me change tracks a little and go back to the investment bank model and funding. One of the things, you know, that we saw both in Bear and initially in Bear, you know, they had a fair amount of repos, I think 50 to 80 billion, I forget the exact amount. And when the run hit them, one of the things that apparently surprised folks at the SEC and the Fed was that, you know, there was a run on repo that was backed by agencies and treasuries, and I guess that caught them a little by surprise. You know, unsecured commercial paper is one thing. Repos that are financing treasuries and agencies were another. Was that something that you were aware of at the time and that surprised you?
I'm not aware of it even until you just told me.
Okay. When you were looking at companies, for example, like Lehman and Bear in 07 and 08, what were you looking at on the funding side of the balance sheet, if anything? I mean, I know you were looking at the asset side of the balance sheet.
I was not looking at the funding side of the balance sheet.
Okay.
So, I was looking at the overall leverage and so forth, but there was not anywhere near the kind of disclosure that you would need to make a judgment of the funding. So I took, from a short seller's perspective, the conservative point of view and just assumed that the funding was fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, that way, if it turned out to be not fine, I mean, that would just mean that the situation was even worse than I realized.
Right, right. What were you looking at that was not company specific in 07 and 08? And obviously, let me just ask, I mean, one of the areas that's probably not surprising that we're looking at is the housing market and just the whole level of you know, the types and the composition of securities that were out there.
Yeah, my attitude was that it was more of a credit bubble than just a housing bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And that you had all kinds of spreads at rates that didn't make any sense, mostly because of securitization, re-securitization, bad behavior by credit rating agencies.
And when you say the spreads didn't make sense because of, I mean, I get the credit rating agency part, but because of securitizations and re-securitizations, what do you mean by that?
You know, this idea of carving up risk and then spreading it out would be securitizations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you have a difference between the person who's originating the loan and the person who ultimately will bear the credit risk if it doesn't perform,
mm-hmm.
or parts of the credit risk. And then re-securitization is taking already securitized, I guess, bonds and putting them into new securitizations. So then you have, those would be generally called either asset-backed CDOs or in some cases CDO squares.
Right. And we've actually been looking at that, and I wanted to ask about this, but did you see any change, and I don't even know if you were looking at it, over time about who was actually purchasing the CDOs? I mean, one of the things we've been looking at, and I think we're close to actually figuring out, is who were purchasing these things over time, and it looks like in 07, in 06, or at least the second half of 06, and throughout, I guess, August of 07, when it pretty much stopped, a lot of the CDO tranches that were being purchased by collateral managers that were simply putting them in other CDOs, and the hedge funds and pension funds and traditional buyers of CDOs were not really there anymore. Do you have any knowledge about that, or at the time or now?
The thing that actually surprised me the most was how much of the stuff was kept at the banks.
So like the Merrills and the Cities of the world?
Yeah, exactly. I was very surprised about that. And in fact, you know, when we did our research in August and September time frame of 2007 to figure out which ones we wanted to, increase our short positions in or cover. We made a number of conclusions that various of these financial institutions did not have large exposures. After reviewing whatever filings and talking to whoever we could talk to, and then those conclusions proved to be incorrect. It turned out that they had much more exposures than anybody could figure out, from a careful reading of their filings and so forth.
Right. And let me ask you about that, because we've seen that too, and in particular in the case of Merrill that everybody started to find out in October of 2007. And that is when you looked at the Q's and K's, you would always get net write downs and net exposures, but you wouldn't get the gross numbers. And I guess everybody at least understood, well, there is a gross exposure, and presumably the difference has to do with monoline hedges and things like that. But I haven't seen personally, at least prior to 3Q07, either analysts on conference calls or analysts in the report saying we need to see the gross numbers so we can have a better idea of what the real exposures were. Was that something that you folks were trying to find out about or were seeing as a deficiency in financial reporting?
Yes, and I would add that we ran into a number of false denials.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't know how you guys and other hedge funds do their business, but I would assume that perhaps after looking at a Q or a K, you actually call up the company and say, hey, we have additional questions. Can you answer them for us? Was that kind of stuff going on at Greenlight?
Sometimes it was.
And of course, we know about the phone call with Aaron Callan on Lehman, but more generally, were companies, willing to provide additional information, for example, on gross real estate exposures?
Different ones in different ways. I remember Morgan Stanley did a pretty good job in particular,
mm-hmm.
even though it then turned out they had some other loss relating to the AAA stuff that we didn't detect. They at least seem sort of aware of things,
mm-hmm.
and their financial supplement was relatively robust compared to their peers. You could contrast that with Citigroup, which disclosed nothing. I mean, thousands of pages, but nothing that you could figure out anything from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, hold on one sec.
How are we doing for time? Because we're kind of getting close here.
Yeah, I mean, we got a timer on ours, and I've got it at 44 minutes, so I figured we had about 15 left, and I'm sure we'll get done in that amount of time if that works
just
for you guys.
Okay, we're on the same page, I think.
Okay. Let's move to bigger picture stuff, and let me just go right to the biggest picture stuff that we're asking folks, and that is, what do you see as the primary causes of the financial crisis?
Right. My answer to that is kind of all of the above. I've read a lot of stuff about people saying it was this thing or it was that thing, and I think it was just all of those things coming together. And I think each of them have some responsibility. I've heard very few of these theories that I would dismiss. Whether it's relating to the regulatory behavior, the legal structures relating to the housing market, the oversight of the lending standards by the bank regulators, the capital requirements of the investment banks, the behaviors of the rating agencies, the failures of the securitization model, the incentives of bankers to game the risk management systems. I think all of that was prevalent, and I think it all contributed.
Mm-hmm. What about one of the things we haven't talked about that's in our statute and that, at least in something,
I read you had mentioned about before, or maybe this is one of the things you can just blame on Michael Lewis, but is the whole role of derivatives, and I think what I saw, it might have been in the January 09 op-ed piece, was particular credit default swaps. Any views on those being a contributing cause to the crisis?
Oh, absolutely. I think the prevalence of derivatives, concentrated derivative positions, where there's still really no disclosure in financial statements, whether they're interest rate derivatives or credit default type derivatives, swap derivatives, I think all of these things contributed to the leverage in the system, and really the hidden and unanalyzable leverage in the system.
Mm-hmm. There's some folks out there that have written that the whole increase in synthetic CDOs, which of course is just another way of saying credit default swaps, contributed to, if not primarily caused, spreads to not widen out on CDO tranches and perpetuated, the prices, those things selling at par, and therefore perpetuated the housing bubble. And any views on that?
You know, the failure of the AAA rated securities had broad, and the belief in the AAA rated securities prior to that had broad implications. And the idea that you could have synthetic securities that were effectively rated AAA that could therefore be given to any large bank where they would essentially be assigned zero capital charge meant that there was practically infinite demand mm-hmm. for AAA rated stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that in effect was a subsidy that allowed all kinds of credit, poor credit and lending decisions to continue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you ever talked, let me go back to what we were talking about before about the value at risk model and how they, don't predict, what's going to happen if you have tail risk at the end of the distribution. Did you ever have any discussions with, for example, the chief risk officers of any of the iBanks or any of the other folks about, these VAR measures that we see in your SEC filings aren't very helpful because they don't fundamentally do what risk management folks are supposed to do, and that is see what's going to happen if you do, God forbid, have a tail risk event?
I don't think I talked to any chief risk officers.
Or what about others?
I don't think in any terribly serious way. I think I've talked to some people somewhere along the line at both Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs about this. Mm-hmm. But not like in a formal presentation,
right.
More like, at dinner or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned earlier you were on the New Century board for about a year. Do you recall when you joined the board?
Yeah, it was the spring of 2006.
Maybe
in May.
And just on this topic, I didn't know this was something you were going to go into. There's
sure.
A bunch of litigation related to New Century that David's been involved in. So, because this is something that's, unlike your typical type of interview with the government, is going to go, as I understand, on a website someday and be public. And this is an area where, I don't know, that we're going to want to get into a ton of in-depth.
And what my question was going to be was really just sort of a high level is, what happened? What were the problems that led to its bankruptcy? Is that something that Mr. Einhorn can address?
No, I don't think that's a topic that you didn't give us a heads up that that was a topic we were going to go into. I haven't discussed it with David before.
Okay,
implications of litigation. So,
sure. What about just how the circumstances of him becoming a director? Just who contacted him, how it came to be.
Okay, I think that's okay.
Yeah, we've been shareholders for a good period of time, and the company earlier on was an originator of loans, of subprime loans, and they were selling the loans. And then somewhere in the years prior to me joining the board, they began to switch their strategy where they began retaining the loans on their balance sheet. And I thought that that was a poor business decision. And rather than sell the stock, because I did like the origination business, I lobbied with a potential proxy fight, which was eventually settled by me joining the board. I lobbied to do that because I wanted to see if I could encourage the company to retain less credit risk and to sort of unwind the decisions that they previously made that I felt were diminishing the value of the business.
So you wanted them to go back to being a traditional mortgage banker?
Correct.
Did they?
No. I didn't have enough time.
Right. And was when you went on the board, did other folks go on the board with you?
No.
Oh, okay, it was all right. Bear with me. Okay, let me just ask you. I know we're getting close. So let me ask you some specific questions about Lehman. Again, I've read the April 08 and the May 08 speeches that you had, and then I think even a speech after their failure in 09, talking about stuff. And we've of course heard the stories about the subsequent conversations with Aaron Callan, or I should say the interim conversation with Aaron Callan. But you know, we've looked at Lehman, and we actually had a hearing on them in the context of Too Big to Fail. And I guess what I'd like you to do is just sort of give us any additional color that you can on what you saw at Lehman that made you short them. Like I said, I've read the speeches, so I know the general story of the real estate positions, the failure to take what you thought were sufficient losses, and the lack of transparency and the lack of good answers that you were getting about changes between earnings disclosures and then the numbers in the Q, where it looked like they had written up stuff by about $1 billion. But other than those things that we already know, what else were you seeing at the company that was giving you folks concern?
Yeah. Fundamentally, Lehman was picked as one of the stocks in August of 2008 without too much work.
I take it you meant August of 2007, right?
I'm sorry, August of 2007 without too much work. I'm getting old. I became particularly alarmed when I heard their subsequent earnings conference call, where they brought their earnings release forward ahead of other investment banks. They had a number of items that they wanted people to exclude from their earnings. And rather than disaggregate them, they lumped them together and refused to say what was what. That included a change in the fair value of their liabilities, which at the time I had never heard of and they were not clear about, but only later, maybe a few days later when Morgan Stanley announced earnings, I figured out was this FAS 159.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that they were generally evasive on their conference call.
And I'm sorry, just so the record's clear, I think you're talking about the call shortly after the Bear deal?
No, way before.
Oh,
I'm
okay.
Talking about at the end of their August quarter, so probably sometime in September.
Okay, thank you.
This is all in September 2007. I became sort of concerned by that, by all those kind of things. This was the time when Lehman was saying that they were hedged, and the world believed that Goldman and Lehman had hedged and nobody else had.
Mm-hmm.
And I began asking questions like, how do you hedge $30 billion of mortgages and $30 billion of commercial real estate? Like, where is that? And that led to the questions I was asking of the rating agencies, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me about the Merck. And because I knew there were these instruments like ABX and CMBX, and I knew you could, if you worked really hard, you could buy $1 billion of them or $2 billion. But I didn't see how anybody was going to be able to do $30 billion of each, which is probably what Lehman might have needed to do to be actually hedged. Then when they released their 10Q, I saw that they moved $9 billion of mortgage assets from level 2 to level 3, and it appeared that they had not written them down. but you couldn't tell for sure. Then in November, I gave a speech about Lehman Brothers at the Value Investors Congress, where I highlighted the risks. And the additional thing I did was I studied what Lehman did in 1998. And in August of 1998, the securitization market also stopped, just as it did 9 years later. And people at the time, we weren't involved with the trading the securities, but I remember the news accounts. People at the time generally thought Lehman Brothers might have been insolvent. And I went back and I reviewed their SEC filings from that time and saw that they never even reported a loss, which suggested to me that they may have a game plan of just sort of denying things and waiting for them to get better. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be consistent with the language they were using in September of 2007, where they thought this was going to be a short-term, one- or two-quarter kind of problem. And so I came to become suspicious. So I gave a speech about all of this at the end of November in 2007. That prompted a conversation at Lehman's request with their management, where, among other things, when Chris, what's his name, O'Meara,
right,
was on the call, I asked him about the $9 billion transfer of the mortgages. Like, when did you do that? Was it during the quarter, at the end of the quarter? And he gave me an answer that said, well, we do this all the time. We mark these things every day. We transfer them back and forth all the time, just whenever it's needed. We mark our whole book every night. And literally in the middle of that call, he had to get off, and they brought on a more junior person to continue the call. And I asked the junior person the exact same question, and I got the opposite answer, that they only mark this at the end of the quarter, that they only put these things on at the end of the quarter, and that they hadn't written them down, which meant to me that this $9 billion of mortgages had been moved from level 2 to level 3 in part to avoid having to write them down.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of carried us through to the end of 2007. And into early 2008, when they started increasing their dividends and announcing enormous share repurchase promises, meanwhile, we were continuing to learn more about what was going on there, whether it was the Archstone Smith deal or various other real estate-oriented transactions that we knew them to be involved with, that appeared to have huge problems, that it didn't seem like there was a place for them to have written them down in their financials. And that's really sort of then what carried us into the Bear Stearns quarter, which was really two quarters later.
Mm-hmm. What about the, and I know we're getting close, so but other than Lehman, of course, you had mentioned Bear, MBI, AmBank, Moody's, Wells Fargo, and HSBC. Again, what were the main things you were seeing in those companies? And you don't have to go through the specifics of each one because we don't have a lot of time left. But if you could just generally tell us what you were seeing.
Right.
And you've already covered some of MBI and AmBank generally, since we know what the concerns
right.
is those are monolines.
Right. The monolines were the monolines. I thought that the rating agencies had huge problems as a result of their actions. And I felt that securitization, which was a big part of their revenue, was going to go away. And I wondered whether there would eventually be legal liability for what they had done.
Mm-hmm.
Bear Stearns was, in my view, a less bad version of Lehman. They just had a balance sheet full of mortgages that it was pretty clear were just not likely to be able to be transacted in. And it wasn't clear to me how they were possibly marking them down enough.
Did you see the same, did you have concerns about the same kind of what I'll term game playing, you know, switching stuff from level 2 to level 3 and that kind of thing?
No, I don't know if it was as much game playing as just simply not writing stuff down.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. All right, well, Mr. Einhorn, I see we are at the end of the time. So thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. We do appreciate it. I will tell you what I tell everybody at the end of these. I think we had everything we need. If we have any follow-up questions, I'll contact your counsel, but I doubt that'll be necessary.
Okay. Do I need to do anything to request the tape, or are you guys just going to send that to me?
Well, you've just done it, so now we will send you a copy of the audio file. It's actually a digital recorder, not a tape. So, yeah, we'll have that sent to you.
Great. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.